This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, activists prepare to occupy the U.S. Department of Injustice, the same department that wants to strip search everybody. Cholera is on the rebound in Haiti, and the U.S. should keep its bloody hands off Mali in West Africa.
But first, a federal appeals court last week upheld California's Proposition 209, the referendum passed 18 years ago that bans affirmative action in state college admissions. The Detroit-based organization BAM, by any means necessary, is leading the fight to preserve affirmative action in higher education nationwide. BAM's organizer, Yvette Farlocky, was part of a group that briefly occupied the registrar's office at the University of California at Berkeley. She says black students have all but disappeared on the campus.
The percentage of black students at UC Berkeley is about hovering at less than 3% and has been pretty steadily ever since the ban on affirmative action. Ever since the university started implementing Prop 209, the percentage of black students has fallen, was stripped and cut almost 50% the first year, and has consistently been behind what's been a growth in black and Latino student population in the K-12 system, as well as the percentage that continue to graduate UC qualified in California and who apply to UC Berkeley and the UC system. UC Berkeley, as the university's flagship campus, should be then the example and the model for a public university education that is open and accessible to all of California's black and Latino and underrepresented minority communities. And instead, it's been the opposite. And so it has been the backwater of the UC system when it comes to racial equality and integration. And so it's meant then that it's a very common situation that black students will often be the only black student in their class, that even in the African American Studies classes at UC Berkeley, it is now rare that black students are a majority of the students in the class. And to us, this is just ridiculous. It's unacceptable because it's 2012, and we have a state with a majority-minority student population. And yet our public university system, flagship campus, UC Berkeley, has continued to segregate and discriminate against our state's majority-minority student population. And to us, that is just hypocrisy, and that is what privatization has led to here at UC Berkeley. And we're going to demand that UC Berkeley do whatever they have to do to change their admissions and to admit more black and Latino students right now, so that way the 2012 freshman class enrolls at least twice as many black students, Latino students, Native American students, and other underrepresented minority students. And the court ruling on Prop 209 was absolutely, obviously it was stupid and ridiculous, but it was also something that was not a surprise to us. It's always been a question of how strong the movement is in fighting for racial equality and integration. It took a civil rights movement and took direct action to open up UC Berkeley and any of these universities to black and Latino students. And regardless of what the court does or doesn't do in reality, it's always been about the action and the movement for us. Because we know history has shown that. And so we're determined to build an independent, integrated, youth-led civil rights movement.
That was Yvette Farlocky in Berkeley. George Washington is BAM's lead attorney in the fight to preserve affirmative action. He says Proposition 209 and laws like it are attempts to bring back the old Jim Crow?
I think there are two basic issues. Number one, Proposition 209 is a direct attack on the political rights of black and Latino people, because every other citizen of the state of California can go to the regents and say they want a special admissions program because the existing was unfair to them in some way or another. And the regents can, if they agree with that, by simple majority vote, change their admissions programs. But for black and Latino people, what Grutter said is the only program which would practically get them admitted, which is to say affirmative action, is completely off the table. They can't win that program unless they fight and win a statewide referendum, which is tens of millions of dollars, which obviously they, you know, black and Latino people don't have generally. And so it's really a separate and unequal political procedure. The second thing is the 14th Amendment was designed, one of its initial intents was to eliminate the black codes, which were special laws directed against employment rights and all kinds of other civil rights of black people in the South after the Civil War. Well, this is not as draconian as that, but it's the same principle. It's a special law that puts a, that gives people the right to sue if the university admits what those action think are too many black people or too many Latinos. And nobody else can sue the University of California for their admissions policies other than this law that empowers the Ward Connerlys and the open racists of this world to sue. And so on both denying the political rights and giving the opponents affirmative action a right to sue, this was designed to drive down black and Latino admissions, and it's done that. And it is a special law that's every bit as unconstitutional as the black codes were 150 years ago.
So those people who belong to what we called protecting classes are actually classes that are specifically not protected.
Yeah, specifically burdened and really excluded. It is a Jim Crow procedure and a Jim Crow law. It says separate political rights, separate and unequal political rights, and separate burdens on the education and therefore employment and career possibilities of black and Latino students. If you think about it, the regents have power over every form of admissions there is, except when it comes to black and Latino students, when the courts of California are supposed to supervise that, that somehow the regents are letting in supposedly unqualified people and so forth. It is every bit the same kind of law as the 14th Amendment was designed to overrule.
In other words, you can help any other group except blacks and Latinos. Give us some examples of these other kinds of groups that can make a special pleading and not be barred for doing so.
Well, there are really three that are, I think, most important. Maybe four. Certainly, poor students have, in general can ask that because they have less educational opportunities and so forth that they be given special consideration. And obviously, we would support that. But it doesn't deal with the fact that if you're poor and black, you're facing a double disadvantage. So it doesn't substitute for affirmative action. But in other words, the law recognizes that lower income status disadvantages you, whatever race you are, and therefore there can be special admission programs for that. The same is true for students from rural backgrounds. The same is true for veterans who obviously had to give up a kind of high school education because they went in the service. And then on the other side of things, the one that's most galling is that people who are sons and daughters of alumni or sons of the rich and famous who give money to the University of California have special admission programs. And four of those we would agree with, a couple of them we would obviously disagree with strongly, but they all can go and win those programs by simple majority vote. But the people who are most disadvantaged, who are most burdened by the segregation and inequality in K through 12 education, are the only groups who are prevented from doing that. That is separate and unequal treatment.
How close are the opponents of any kind of affirmative action to winning an across-the-board slam-dunk, it's-all-over-now victory?
I don't think they're as close as some of the media are saying. I think the Texas case, for example, I don't think is going to rule at all on whether affirmative action is itself constitutional. They're going to rule on the specific Texas program. And the Texas case, I think, is particularly revealing because right now, today, in the state of Texas, 60% of high school graduates are black or Latino, 44% Latino, 16% black. And yet you go to the University of Texas and you've got 18, 19, 20% admits in that category. So it's a one-third what one would expect. And what's strange about Texas is that you have a Republican attorney general who's defending the University of Texas plan. And I think in many ways they recognize that this is simply not viable. As bad as they are on so many issues, I think they recognize that Texas, which is even more of a majority-minority state than California among young people, that it's just not possible to have a Texas in which you have an all-white or nearly all-white university in a state where 60% now are black or Latino among high school graduates.
So even Texas Republicans, at least the governor, understands that there must be some kind of affirmative action in some form, even if he doesn't call it that.
I think that's right. And of course, Texas has the 10% plan, which is has many good features to it. I think, and I don't want to paint up the Texas Republican Party because that's a terrible organization and a racist organization, but even they are having to argue for affirmative action. And our Supreme Court, one would think they might have lost their minds when you heard the last argument on health care, but presumably or hopefully they will recognize that in a country which is going to be majority-minority very soon, it is suicidal to and wrong to exclude the kids who will be the majority of this country.
Attorney George Washington for BAM, by any means necessary.
The killing of teenager Trayvon Martin in Florida has sparked more black protest than has been seen in decades. Los Angeles-based educator and writer Sikivu Hutchinson says white supremacy is reasserting itself. In a recent article published in Black Agenda Report, Ms. Hutchinson evoked the whites-only school book world of Dick and Jane, a place and time where the Trayvon Martins of America were not allowed.
I was trying to evoke the post-war construction of American childhood innocence, and the degree to which Trayvon Martin obviously runs counter to that is subversive of that whole ideology of the white nuclear family, white picket fence-oriented suburban articulation of what it means to be an American and what it particularly means to be an American child. And so, you know, we definitely have been inundated, you know, with all of these images of childhood innocence, stolen innocence with regard to missing and abducted young white women, how that's been really foisted down our throats ad nauseum, you know, that these are the lives that need to be protected, and that we have these criminal others like Trayvon Martin when they enter into gated communities and other protected enclaves, that that's really a disruption, you know, of this archetypal, you know, as you mentioned, paradigm of childhood and of American innocence. And I thought that evoking the Dick and Jane iconography was really critical here because not only was Dick and Jane a way to configure American relationships to literacy, but the Primers really became very central during that post-war period, where all of these images of the normalcy of white suburbia were being articulated, where white families were really entering into the whole economy of the American dream via programs like the Federal Housing Administration, mortgage lending programs, you know, which systematically discriminated against African American homeowners, the GI Bill that allowed scores and scores of white returning veterans to get a leg up into the American dream by getting a college education. And all of those institutions, those New Deal institutions, you know, were critical to defining, of course, the architecture of white suburbia, but also this architecture of, you know, the nuclear, heterosexual, upwardly mobile, striving, laissez-faire family model that racial others could never, ever gain access to, and which, you know, this whole paradigm was really constructed upon the othering of African American and other families of color.
And even Dick and Jane's neighborhood, as depicted in the school books, was a place where a Trayvon was not supposed to be.
Absolutely. So this whole idea that this white Latino murderer, assassin, that he could just stalk Trayvon with impunity and that he was conferred, you know, with legitimacy with regard to protecting the gated community and the interests of the gated community, you know, harkening back to the white-dominated homeowners associations and, you know, other entities, you know, was really to protect and preserve white suburban homeowning interest and white American access to upward mobility within the capitalist mode. And so, again, racial others were fundamentally excluded from that. But the subtext in terms of looking at the white nationalist, you know, uprising and hysteria that's emerged over the past couple of years, you know, the subtext is we did not use these entities, these institutions, as a vehicle for uplift. That basically we relied upon free enterprise, we relied upon the market, we relied upon, you know, the bootstraps ethos in order to carve out part of the American dream. And obviously we know, you know, that's an egregious lie and an egregious insult to, you know, all of the civil and human rights resistance that peoples of color waged in the United States, you know, in order to simply be defined as human, defined as a citizen, defined as, you know, having agency and purchase. And so I thought it was critical to weave that in, and also to unpack this notion of this space of ambiguity that exists around Latino identity, because initially the gunman was identified as being solely white, and then all of a sudden there was this sort of parallel discourse that emerged that, well, no, he was Latino, and he could not have racially profiled Trayvon, the subtext being that there was some reflexive solidarity that, you know, Latinos have, you know, for African Americans, when in fact there is a lot of cultural and political ambiguity, you know, that exists around Latino categorization in terms of being granted this sort of provisional access to whiteness, you know, in terms of the census categories of Latino identity, being, you know, connected to, you know, white racial identity as opposed to an ethnic identity that is more of color. So I thought that that was also, you know, critical to bring in terms of this narrative of Latino assimilation, you know, into the white American dream.
And in fact, in many regions, a majority of Latinos list their race as white.
Absolutely. So, you know, this idea that there's some reflexive solidarity that exists, you know, particularly when it comes to issues of criminalization of the body of color, of the black body, that there's a very specific legacy that is absolutely steeped in slavery and colonization and the over-incarceration, you know, of young African American males in particular, that we need to keep in mind, you know, when evoking these themes of reflexive solidarity amongst peoples of color.
Scholar and activist Sikivu Hutchinson speaking from Los Angeles.
April 24th is the birthday of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. On that day, activists will descend on the U.S. Justice Department to protest systemic racism in the criminal justice system. Benjamin Woods, a doctoral candidate at Howard University, is an organizer of Students Against Mass Incarceration.
Right here in D.C., our organization, Students Against Mass Incarceration, in league with another student organization, the Organization of Graduate Sociologists, going to be co-sponsoring a symposium on the impact of mass incarceration on Black America. It's going to include two panels, and actually Mumia Abu-Jamal will call in, and he's going to discuss the reason why the call for the march and the impact of mass incarceration as he sees it, as someone who's been in prison for over 30 years now as a political prisoner. And we'll have Jared Ball, who will be moderating the program as well, and people such as Keto Swan, who studies the Black Power Movement, and others on a particular panel of scholar activists from the D.C., Maryland area, as well as another panel of more grassroots activists, people like Dominique Stevenson, who co-wrote the memoir with Marshall Eddie Conway, people like Matt Gaskins, who recently was released from prison, who was part of the Minister of Information for the New African Black Panther Party chapter, with Kevin Rashid Johnson. So the point is, we'll have one that's more about raising consciousness, and then the other will be focused on the issue of strategy. What can we do? Hooking students up with organizations and how they can plug in and really support people who are already on the ground doing work, and really really mobilize for this march, because on April 24th, because this is going to be something major, and we're trying to see this as a way to really kickstart, even though, you know, the movement is already going, but to really push the movement in higher gear around this issue of mass incarceration and political prisoners in this country, and really prison abolition, and really putting, I think, that back on the table is going to be one of our central ideas, is the idea of prison abolition, as Angela Davis and others have discussed in the past, and really trying to bring that, as opposed to just prison reform or let's stop police brutality, but a whole range of issues connected to prison.
I would expect that a lot of mainline black organizations wouldn't touch this kind of action because, after all, there's a black man at the head of the U.S. Justice Department.
Well, I mean, I think that's the issue that Michelle Alexander talked about in her book, The New Jim Crow, right? Other organizations, the more mainstream ones, as you discussed, you know, because certain, you know, they saw this as a lower class problem or people who would embarrass them or make them not be able to, you know, integrate or assimilate into society better, make other, in their eyes, other black folk look bad, you know, which is really just their own class, their own bourgeois striving, who don't want to really touch this. And I think it's necessary for us to really inject ourselves as we see people like, you know, a lot of organizations latching on to Troy Davis and Trayvon Martin, that the people who've been organizing around this for years, people like the MOVE organization, PAM Africa, and so many others, Angela Davis, and just so many other organizations that are local and maybe not national, and that have been organizing around this issue in a more militant way and really pushing the idea of the fact that we don't need prisons in society, this idea of abolition. And I think that's what we really want to put back on the table, is the idea of what is an alternative to prison. How can we create something to where and transform society to where these are no longer necessary.
You have a very provocative article scheduled for Black Agenda Report. It's titled Stand Whose Ground, and it's a reference clearly to the Stand Your Ground law that was used as the excuse for releasing Mr. Zimmerman, the killer of Trayvon Martin.
This is something recently, I have a blog that I have, as well as I write for the student newspaper here at Howard University. And I was really discussing the Southern Poverty Law Center for a recent publication, but it's something that people have been discussing for the last few years now. Their intelligence report publication, they talked about the year in hate and extremism, and there's an explosion in the number of right-wing, these white nationalist groups, militias, patriot movement organizations that have exploded across the country, and really putting Trayvon Martin and these, you know, people are really now really more paying attention to this fact that people like sisters like Rekia Boyd, who was murdered in Chicago, and these just rash of people paying attention to these police murders and even just vigilantism that's going, there's a wave of it that's going across the country, and putting it in that context, and even trying to raise the issue of, in the past, if the government has not been able to defend us, then the necessity of even talking about self-defense is needs to be put on the table. So that's one of the things we try to do, is put these other ideas back on the table and try to put them into practice in some way.
You even make reference to one of the red summers, those summers that ran red with blood because white mobs were attacking black folks in cities all across the country, 1919, when those mobs attacked the black community and blacks in Washington, D.C. stood their ground.
Exactly. I think that's something as younger people that we're, you know, this is almost 100 years ago now. We're not really taught this history. You know, students are coming from all over the country and even the world to come to Howard University and to really know and understand what has happened here. And it was the Washington Post that ran an article saying that a white woman in southwestern D.C. had been raped by a black man, which no evidence to really substantiate that. And whites went through on a rampage throughout the city, just murdering innocent black people. But what was important is that after a day or two, black people really got the idea, hey, we're going to have to protect ourselves. And so they begin to, you know, you had a lot of World War One veterans that were around, right? They had just come back home, and they're not going to just accept this, accept being attacked after they fought for their country, after they've seen the world and know how to protect and defend themselves. So they began to organize. Right down the street, there was a Howard Theater that's actually being revented. You know, it's interesting. This Howard Theater now was really had declined, closed, and now it's being rebuilt around this area through gentrification. But on top of the Howard Theater, they actually had people who were essentially snipers in self-defense in case they saw any white people rampaging, hey, take them out. So this is just putting this idea of, you know, self-defense. You know, you talk about stand your ground laws. We've stood our ground at certain points.
And this didn't begin with Malcolm X or Deacons for Self-Defense or the Black Panther Party.
This goes all the way back to enslavement period. And you can talk about insurrections. Obviously, people know the big names, Nat Turner, Denmark V. You can go all the way back to the 18th century of Jimmy and Stono Rebellion. I mean, it goes all the way back. Black people have been fighting nonstop since the beginning. And I think that's the idea. You know, people who are trying to be scholars need to really get that point across to the next generation. Is the fact that they're... with a continuous militant resistance among black people to this day.
That was Benjamin Woods of Students Against Mass Incarceration.
Lawyers for California prison inmates held in solitary confinement are bringing their case to the United Nations. Peter Shea of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law says putting people in solitary for years at a time amounts to torture, a violation of international law.
California is somewhat unique in a sense that the majority of people who seem to be placed in solitary confinement are not placed in solitary confinement because they've possessed contraband or because they've attempted to escape or because they've threatened violence against a prisoner or a prison guard or because they've actually assaulted a prisoner or a prison guard or engaged in other wrongdoing. The majority appear to be placed into solitary confinement based on mere gang membership or mere association in a gang. Never had to do anything wrong above and beyond your mere association or your mere membership. Next, the proof of that membership is paper thin. I mean, the elements for it's hard to even call it proof, the elements that are used by prison officials to designate somebody, they call it to validate somebody, but it's basically to designate a prisoner as a gang member or a gang associate, or highly questionable. It could be something as simple that they have a series of factors, and then it's any three or four. If you have any three of these factors, then you can designate the person as a gang member. But the factors themselves really do not establish gang membership, even if gang membership was a justification for placing somebody in solitary confinement, which we don't believe it is. But even if it was, the elements are absurd. They could be, for example, that at the time of your trial, one of your co-defendants was a gang member or a gang associate. Well, that trial could have been 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. Another is that somehow they've come into possession of a picture, a photograph of the prisoner, and there's a gang member in the photograph. Again, that picture could be years old. It doesn't have to be recent. A third would be that another prisoner has reported that he saw a prisoner give a hand signal that was a gang signal, or saw a prisoner associate with gang members. So the criteria are not exactly very powerful criteria. Once a person is designated as an associate of a gang or a member of a gang, then they're placed in solitary confinement, in segregation, isolated segregation, until one of two things happens. Either they, in the terminology of the prison authorities, they debrief. The regulation makes it very clear that debriefing means that they have to become an informant. It's not just, oh, I disavow my gang. That's nothing close. The regulations specifically say that they have to become an informant, they have to provide names, they have to provide information about the structure, this, that, and the other thing. Well, very few prisoners are willing to do that because if they did that, their life would be very seriously at risk. And the only other way that they can get out of solitary confinement is if they have been, quote, gang-free, for, unquote, for 6 years. So you're in solitary, you're effectively in solitary confinement for years and years and years, no matter what.
So we're talking about 400 inmates in California that you're representing, and maybe 25,000 in the United States who have been put in solitary confinement for long periods of time. How can the United Nations give your clients and that much larger group relief?
Number one, they cannot give direct relief to prisoners outside of California because to make this somewhat manageable, we've limited our petition to prisoners in California. It's several thousand, and it's the highest number. Certainly, it's the highest number in the country. In fact, it's the highest number of prisoners in some sort of solitary confinement in any country on the face of the earth. So, but what could they do with regards to California? Number one, they will decide whether they have competency over the petition, whether they believe they have jurisdiction over the petition. We've requested that they make a determination that they do. Number two, they can seek a formal response from the government of the United States. They would, in essence, get in touch with the State Department. They would give the State Department a copy of the petition, and they would say, we would like to see a response from the government of the United States. That would force the government of the United States to turn to the state of California, to the governor's office, to the prison authorities, and say to them, we need some response. We need to figure out how we're going to respond to this thing, how we're going to argue that this is not, does not amount to a violation of our obligations under international law. We need to explain how this does not constitute torture. But we request, and they certainly have the power to seek a formal response. We also request that as promptly as reasonably possible, that they consider conducting an on-site visit to inspect and review the California Prison Segregation Housing Unit. They would probably only do that after getting a response from the U.S. government, and this can take months and months. These committees, the special rapporteur can act more promptly than the working group will probably act, but these things can take a while to unfold. But we have requested that they consider conducting an on-site inspection and review of the California Prison Segregation Housing Units. Next, we've requested that if they conduct such an on-site inspection, that they interview prisoners who are petitioners and other prisoners detained in isolated segregation solely based on their alleged gang membership or association with a gang. We have also requested that they call upon the government of the United States to allow representatives of the Red Cross to visit the prisoners and to assess their medical and mental health records in terms of confinement. We have also requested that they call upon the government of the United States to ensure that California permits an independent panel of medical experts to review the petitioners' medical and mental health records and interview petitioners to assess the impact of their isolated segregation on their mental and physical health. We've also called upon them to, in effect, call upon the government of the United States to ensure that California prisoners in isolated segregation are not punished merely for protesting through hunger strikes, the cruel conditions of their confinement. And finally, we've requested that they ultimately would issue a report holding that the lengthy or indefinite placement of California prisoners in isolated segregation merely based upon their alleged association with or membership in a gang is disproportionate to the status alleged and constitutes cruel and degrading treatment in violation of and torture in violation of international law, and that they call upon the government of the United States to take all necessary steps to ensure that California terminates this policy of violation of international law.
you seem to anticipate that, at the very least, these petitions can embarrass the United States.
I wouldn't necessarily use the word embarrass, but I think that certainly filing these petitions can help to focus attention on what I think is barbaric treatment of several thousand people in California and then beyond California. And by focusing attention, it can help perhaps encourage a discussion about whether California's policy is an enlightened policy and a forward-looking policy, or is it a regressive, medieval, barbaric policy. So we're hopeful that not only will these petitions result in some concrete action by the United Nations, but we're also hopeful that it helps to raise the issue, the profile of the issue, and that it helps to move it on to the agenda at some point of the head of prisons in California and the governor of California and the legislative leaders. Although this policy, I must point out, is not a law. This is a regulation. This is not a law enacted by the legislative of California. This is a regulation adopted by some prior governor's administration. So it is something that Governor Brown could alter, could modify. Now they have issued some modified, proposed new regulations on solitary confinement just a few weeks ago. However, on this issue, they really don't propose much. The only thing they propose is that instead of being in solitary confinement until you've been, quote, gang free, unquote, for 6 years, you would be held in solitary confinement until you've been gang free for 4 years. To me, that's not much of a difference. If they wanted to say you could be held in solitary confinement for mere gang membership or association for a week or 10 days, that might be proportionate. But when you put somebody in there for much longer than a few days, the psychological impact, the physical health impact is so tremendous that it does become torture.
The right-wing majority on the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that police and jail personnel can strip search anyone entering the general jail population, no matter how minor the charge. What many people don't realize is that the Obama Justice Department argued in favor of the decision. Obama's lawyers were especially eager to strip search political activists. Glenn Ford has this commentary.
Humiliation is the law of the land. When you fall into the clutches of the police for any reason or no good reason at all, you can be compelled to bare your private parts before being placed in the general jail population. 5 of the 9 U.S. Supreme Court justices ruled that constitutional prohibitions against unreasonable searches end at the jailhouse door, even if there's no reason to suspect that the person under arrest is in possession of anything that could be called contraband. The decision throws out laws against unreasonable strip searches in at least 10 states and overrides federal law enforcement regulations against intrusive searches. The High Court decision also flies in the face of international human rights treaties to which the United States is a signatory. In effect, the U.S. Supreme Court majority ruled that the whim of the local jailer trumps any standard of reasonableness. The American Correctional Association, which represents jail guards, is pleased that its members now have the flexibility to look into virtually every human orifice that enters their domain, even though the association's own standards currently discourage blanket policies of strip searching everyone. The casual observer might conclude that the ruling is more evidence of a right-wing court on the warpath against what remains of the Bill of Rights. But on this issue, the Obama administration is marching in lockstep with the High Court's right-wing majority. U.S. Justice Department lawyers spoke and filed briefs in favor of blanket strip searches. Indeed, the oral argument put forward by Obama's lawyer was perhaps the most curious of all. Most of the discussion about the smuggling of contraband into jail settings involves drugs or crude weapons and other petty criminal concerns, the day-to-day stuff of life in a jail. But the administration's lawyer chose to use hypothetical political protesters as the bad guys of his argument. In this weird scenario, a protester with a gun, traveling in a car that was about to be stopped by police, would hide the gun on his person in hopes of avoiding a pat-down search, and then bring the gun into the jail when he's arrested, presumably for some minor offense connected to the demonstration. This is quite strange reasoning and shows what kinds of conversations the Obama folks are having at the U.S. Justice Department. Crushing political dissent, not safety in jails, is what motivates the Obama administration to ally itself with the most reactionary wing of the Republican-dominated Supreme Court. The left is not paranoid. The Obama administration really is preparing its legal arsenal to smash dissent in the United States. They're getting ready for a full-spectrum assault on civil and political freedoms, ranging from the big hammer, suspension of all due process through preventive detention, to the intimately chilling effect on potential protesters of knowing that Uncle Sam wants to look into all of your bodily cavities if you get arrested at a demonstration. Obama's lawyer wasn't talking off the cuff before the U.S. Supreme Court. This administration is obsessed with political protesters. They want you to bend over and spread them, literally and politically.
A coalition called Americans for a Fair Estate Tax is urging passage of a Senate bill that would restore the tax on inherited wealth to levels that existed under the Clinton administration. Republicans call it the death tax, and it was drastically reduced under President Bush. Tim Sullivan of United for a Fair Economy says allowing the rich to pass on all their wealth creates vast social inequalities.
The estate tax does a lot to reduce those accumulated fortunes, and right now we've got very little check on that. And so what happens is you get the concentration of wealth that we're seeing right now, which is really at epidemic proportions. It's the worst it's been since before the Great Depression. And the estate tax is at its weakest level, near its weakest level since it was first put into place nearly 100 years ago. So what happens with society is what we're seeing happen now. It crumbles. You get protest movements like the Occupy Wall Street movement, who's completely right. It's the very top of the top is accumulating a massive amount of money, and the rest of us are seeing our services cut and seeing the opportunity for advancement disappear as the wealth accumulates at the very top of the spectrum.
Every time there are demands for higher taxes on the rich, or at least some taxes on the rich, we hear the rich defended as the great job creators of society.
We do hear that quite a bit. And if you're sitting on a multi-million dollar fortune, you're not using that money to create jobs. It's what the estate tax does is recycles that money and puts it back into the economy, and helps to generate the demand and the type of society that can sustain a robust economy, not one where a few people benefit and everybody else struggles more and more.
Many Americans don't know that U.S. society now is more stratified, there is less mobility and more income inequality than most countries in Europe.
It's true, and it's gotten to be that way, and there's nothing that seems to change that. I mean, inequality is going up across the board, and rather than dealing with that in the way that makes sense and looking at policies to reduce it, we're saying, oh, no, we can't possibly do that. It's just going to keep getting worse, and that's what we're willing to tolerate. You mentioned that the Republicans like to call the estate tax the death tax, and it really isn't. It only applies to the estates of such a tiny slice of the population that it is in fact a tax on inherited wealth, not a tax on job creation or punishment for success. It's, like I said, a recycling program for economic activity.
However, Republicans couldn't sustain these low or no estate taxes by themselves. Democrats have also joined in defending the privileges of the rich.
Oh, that's right. But the Republicans are proposing, all of the Republican presidential candidates propose eliminating the estate tax altogether. What President Obama and the Democrats are proposing is just a little bit better, but it's still not good tax policy. They're proposing basically leaving the estate tax at the lowest levels from the Bush tax cuts, which were just a terrible set of tax policies, and there's no reason that we should continue with the worst level of them, but that is, in fact, what President Obama is proposing. So what we're saying, and really a broad, diverse coalition of over 70 groups nationally and locally are saying, is that it needs to be better than that. We can set the levels lower and the rates higher and still only impact the top 1% who would have to pay it.
I remember when George Bush was campaigning to eliminate the estate tax, and he enlisted the support of one of our first black billionaires, Bob Johnson, who owned Black Entertainment Television. And Bob Johnson's line was that the estate tax threatened to wipe out the first generation of black millionaires.
There have been some black millionaires before Bob Johnson, and he did take that line, but the number of people of color who would pay the estate tax is much smaller. We think it's important to look at the impact of policy on race, and the reality is that this will have very little impact on sort of wealth creation and on entrepreneurship and the sources of wealth that come from communities of color. It wouldn't have made Bob Johnson not a billionaire, I think, is one of the other key points. It's a small tax on a portion of his accumulated fortune.
And in fact, your group points out that no farm has ever been foreclosed solely because of the estate tax.
Well, the people who like to talk about how it's really bad for farmers were unable to find a single one who actually had lost their farm. Your first $1 million is not taxed. It's not the tax on, like you said, job creators or small family farms. It's taxed on large accumulated fortunes.
That was Tim Sullivan of United for a Fair Economy in Boston.
Tuareg rebels have seized the northern part of the African country of Mali and proclaimed a separate nation. The conflict is a spillover from the U.S. and NATO war against Libya last year. The Malian army had earlier mutinied and overthrown the country's elected president. In Richmond, Virginia, the defenders of freedom, justice, and equality are demanding that the U.S. not interfere in the Mali crisis. Anna Edwards has visited Mali several times. She says the conflict is more than just an ethnic dispute between minority Tuaregs and other Africans.
I think the greater issue is the fact that between the colonial divisions and creating the nation state's boundaries as they exist now, and then since independence, the fortification of those boundaries left out a nomadic people that did not end up with any kind of land base of their own. And then with the desert growing, the desertification, I guess as it's called, of the area, their ability to be able to be independent in terms of growing their own food, in terms of being able to develop even in the regions where they are, continues to be compromised. So they're just, you know, the impoverishment grows with every generation. And I talked to one friend who said, you know, it's every 20 years it seems like there's a rebellion because you have a new crop of young people who are frustrated by the circumstances of the Tuareg communities up there. And there are a couple of different groups of people as well in terms of what they refer to as Tamilshek-speaking people. And again, there are folks up there who were serving in the Malian army. If you look into it further, there are Tuareg people who wanted to work within the framework of Mali as it exists now. But I think, again, with the destabilization of Libya and the return to the country of, you know, people who were part of an army that was essentially defeated, but who are, you know, have the weaponry and came back and saw that there was an opportunity to develop a land base, to grab a land base, it's not hard to understand why they would want to take advantage of this particular moment.
And observers did predict that the U.S. and NATO attack on Libya would have the result of setting the Sahel, that arid region, on fire.
It's not hard to see. When you look at the dynamic across the Sahel region, the way that, in fact, Libya was a primary, both political in terms of its role with the African Union and wanting to sort of push for an African-centric, unified, you know, national political base. At the same time, it provided a real resources, real money into nations, particularly those with primarily Islamic focus. You know, they provided funding. They provided funding. They provided training. In fact, you know, some of the problem with the fact that there were Farag from Mali who were working in Libya was because he provided jobs. He hired them in the army when there were no other jobs for people. There was an interview with a little boy that I saw where he said, you know, where am I going to go now and where am I going to get work now that Libya is no more? So, yeah, Libya played a critical role in stabilizing that region, even though it was often a problematic role.
And what role is the United States playing? You and others who wrote the report from the Virginia Defender on Mali say that the United States is pumping in at least $140 million a year, and about half of that is for development of some kind and the military.
And I think that's the key. If you look at the AFRICOM website, they're actually not too bad at recording exactly what they're doing. They try to make everything look like humanitarian aid, but all of it really does seem to be geared towards, one, developing a dependence, a military training and equipping dependents upon the United States. The money that goes in for development is to fund, they have a post in the northern town of Tessalit, which was one of the early cities to fall to the Tuareg rebellion. But that's a city that's very close to the border of Algiers, and it's an area where there is, they know that there is oil in that region, and they have already begun to pay for oil research to find, you know, the geological surveys in order to find where the oil is. Whatever the U.S. says in terms of the humanitarian aid aspect of $140 million, the bulk of it is being implemented through AFRICOM and the desire to find an actual base on African soil. You know, we're not trusting what they're saying in terms of, I don't trust that, but humanitarian aid part, you know, you do that, but it's just like any other missionary operation. You do that in order to establish a base of operations from which to pursue your other goals. And in this instance, I think it's geopolitical and it's oil control.
And let's talk about the mutiny of the Malian army. This is the army with which the United States maintains a very close officer-to-officer relations, but
yes,
it overthrew the elected president about a month before his term was supposed to end.
Yeah, I mean, you have to wonder because, for one thing, we were sort of joking over the fact that the Malians, when they're brought over here for training in that army, are brought to North Dakota. And so how there's a terrain relationship between North Dakota and Mali is very hard to sort of see. But it makes you wonder, you know, what are they training them for? Because if this is an army that then couldn't defend itself against what is really a relatively small number of forces that came against them, that there's something amiss about that training, which then, you know, also makes me think, well, what are they doing there and what is the ultimate purpose? It almost seems as though the purpose was to contribute to a destabilization of the region so that then they are even more dependent upon the U.S.
Anna Edwards of Defenders of Freedom, Justice and Equality in Richmond, Virginia.
The rainy season has returned in Haiti, and with it an increase in deaths from cholera. The disease was introduced into the country by troops from the United Nations Occupation Force, MINUSTAH. It has already killed 7,000 Haitians and infected 500,000 more. Mark Weisbort, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, says the foreigners that run Haiti have an obligation to clean up the mess they created.
The only way you really get rid of cholera is to have adequate clean water and sanitation. That's how they got rid of it when you had an outbreak in Peru and other countries in the early 90s. And that's what they have to do in Haiti. And they really, the UN in particular, has a responsibility to do it because they brought it there. And they're still denying it. They still have, I mean, Bill Clinton, who's the top UN official now, is the only one who's really said on the record, you know, that yes, the UN brought the cholera to Haiti. But, you know, it's killed 7,000 people. More than 500,000 have been infected. And now you have a rainy season again, and this is what we've been worried about the most, because last year they cut back on treatments, the international community and NGOs cut back on treatment centers and resources to deal with the cholera right before the rainy season, because, of course, it drops down then. And then it was completely predictable. It flared up again, and you had a lot of excess death. And now you've had 15 cholera deaths in just 8 days from March 8th to 16th, which is way up from what you had, you know, in the previous 2 months. You had 13 deaths for all of February and 8 in January. So this is the rainy season again, and once again, they're not prepared for it.
Well, wait a minute. The United Nations is the repository of vast health resources, the World Health Organization. How could it not be aware of these elementary facts of cholera?
Well, they're aware, but they're just not doing enough. And that's the problem. I mean, it doesn't get a lot of press. You did have a 6,000-word article in the New York Times on, I think it was Sunday, which I think helps. I mean, Haiti is just not in the news unless something big or drastic happens. And I think that, you know, they just don't care enough.
Well, it seems that it may be rooted to their reluctance to admit fully their guilt.
Yeah, I think that could be part of it, although they could just do what they're supposed to do even without admitting it. But I think it is very important. They really should admit it, and everybody knows it. There's been a whole number of studies have been published now by the, you know, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, by the New England Journal of Medicine. There was another one by 15 scientists back in August of last year that was really definitive, because they actually got samples of the cholera bacteria itself from Nepal. So all of these studies, they all point in the same direction. This is where it was brought by UN troops from South Asia. And, you know, even if they didn't do it on purpose, obviously, probably, almost certainly they didn't, but it is gross negligence. Haiti is a public health nightmare, given the lack of clean water. Most of the country doesn't have clean water or sanitation. You just have to be careful. And they weren't careful, first of all, about making sure that people who came there, they could have screened every, you know, especially, or not even taken people from areas where there was cholera in terms of troops. And then they dumped their, you know, human waste in the country's main water supply. So that is just extreme. It's gross negligence. And there's just a lot more they could do. And, you know, they've spent $7 billion on this UN troops occupying the country for just a fraction of that. I mean, a very small fraction of that. They could get rid of cholera in Haiti.
And that's it for this week's edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Millie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.